Don't be silly. I got a towel and put it around his arm. I think it was his right arm. I think he flicked the towel off first. Then he pulled the string out of the light socket. I went in our bedroom, and he was throwing more things, my little ornaments. He went into the kitchen. I've got a glass dining table, and I said, "Please don't smash it." But he picked up some salt and pepper pots and went into the bedroom and threw them out of the window. And he picked up the mirror, so I closed the window, and I grabbed him, and we both fell back on the bed, sobbing, and I was holding him. He cut my arm. I don't know what it was, but I moved my arm. Shows right forearm cuts. I moved my arm and he elbowed me in the stomach. I put my arm over again. He cut and bit my arm. Shows cuts and bruising, right upper arm. I picked up a piece of tie at the side of the bed, sobbing. It was on the bedside cabinet on the left side, and I just strangled him with it. I didn't want to hurt him. I just wanted to stop him hurting me. I just didn't know. I just didn't want him hurting me any more. I was shouting at him to leave me alone, to get off me. Get off me! Get off me! Then when he stopped hitting me, I ran out of the house and came here. Q, when you were strangling Tony, were you on top of him on the bed, or him on top of you, or side by side? Which was it? A. We was near enough side by side. I was on the left side of the bed. I was on my back. He was on my leg below me. I wasn't trapped. He hit me in the stomach a few times. I got the tie around his neck, sobbing. Q. Carry on. A. I crossed the tie over. I pulled it tight to stop him hitting me. I don't know how long for, but when he stopped punching me, I ran out of the house and ran here. Q. Did you mean to kill him? A. Sobbing. No, I didn't want to kill him. Q. Did you think you'd killed him? A. I knew I'd hurt him because he kept trying to catch his breath. He went purple. His mouth, his tongue. His tongue was sticking out. I looked at him. I knew I hurt him. I just had to get out of the house. I had to get here to get help for Tony. I told the man straight away, the policeman. Teresa went on to say that Tony had assaulted her in the past, but, amid much sobbing, that she loved him and felt he needed her. It seemed she was a very young mother. She and Tony must have had the baby when they were still in their teens, trapped in an abusive domestic relationship by her belief that he needed her. I was moved by her protests, her insistence that this was the first time she had retaliated, and then only under immense physical threat from Tony. Sometimes perpetrators seem more like victims, and Teresa was both suffering and remorseful. But the prosecution was planning to rely on my evidence, which had to be unbiased. So I was determined to adhere to the truth with its beautiful simplicity and not allow emotion with all its treachery to muddy that simplicity. The case conference was held in one of the Crown Prosecution Service rooms above the Old Bailey. The courtrooms are majestic and wood-panelled. There is no court in the UK that gives participants more of a sense of justice, its history and importance, than Court One of the Old Bailey. There is nothing majestic, however, about the offices above. I waited in a room with battered furniture and ill-fitting windows, and suddenly counsel, a senior and a junior, burst in. They had come straight from their case in the court below, still wearing their gowns, thrown their wigs on the table, greeted me by name before the more formal proceedings began. The two detectives arrived shortly afterwards. Spending time at a post-mortem together can be a bonding experience, and we shook hands warmly like friends. We sat around a large, scratched table drinking tea from china mugs. Barristers didn't do polystyrene, with the various files and photographs spread out before us. All of the Metropolitan Police photographs were put into small folders with stiff brown covers bound by black plastic rings. I was silent as everyone else discussed Teresa Lazenby's plea. The charge was murder, but they thought it was highly likely that her counsel would offer a plea of guilty to manslaughter with diminished responsibility, which, of course, carried a much shorter sentence. The detectives were keen that this would be accepted. It was obvious that they liked Teresa and that they believed she had acted in self-defense. Indeed, unusually when the defendant has been charged with murder, they had not even objected when she was released on bail. "Have you read her police interview, Dr. Shepherd?" senior counsel asked me. "Yes." And you've seen the pictures of what he did to her before she grabbed the tie? Asked the detective. No, I didn't receive those pictures. There was a lot of shuffling, and then the barrister produced a folder. The police photo folders I usually saw contained pictures of murder scenes and of postmortems. This folder was different. From the pages stared a pretty young woman who was very much alive. So, I said, this is Teresa. Her youth and health lit up the pictures. She was fresh-faced, and her long red hair was sensibly tied back. Just as the detectives had told me all those months ago, she was rather sweet-looking, a world apart from the usual murder suspect. I carefully examined each photo while everyone else sipped their tea and chatted. Finally, I looked up. I said, I think... Then I paused. Was I sure? I did not want to be blinded by any preconceptions of the case into forgetting the horrific consequences of a mistake. The police officers watched me intently, waiting. The lawyers frowned. The pause went on too long. Yes, prompted senior counsel, in a tone that indicated my hesitation could be jeopardizing the credibility of what I was about to say. Then I remembered that nagging doubt I had felt on the day of the postmortem. It was caused, even then, by a dissonance between fact and story. And now I had found another major divergence between the truth and Teresa's version of it. Yes, I was sure. I said, I think all Teresa's injuries are self-inflicted. Counsel for the prosecution gaped at me. What? She did all these things to herself. His junior colleague reached for the photos. Those cuts on her arm. You're saying she made them? I believe so. I do not believe that she killed Anthony Pearson in self-defense, because he was attacking her with glass, razors, what have you. They exchanged glances. You'll say that in court? Yes. I'd like more time to study this case, of course. How? The detective inspector was unshockable, but he looked miserable. How can you be so sure that Tony Pearson didn't cut her? In fact, the injuries in the pictures bore all the classic hallmarks of self-infliction. If you're being attacked, you get out of the way, twist, move, do something. You can't help it. Unless you're being pinned down, which Teresa says she wasn't, or you're immobilized by drugs or alcohol, which she clearly wasn't, then you simply don't let someone slice your skin over and over again, in the same direction and in the same place. And there was further evidence. The wounds were only in the most common sites for self-inflicted injuries. The sites are common because they're easily accessible, and the force used was only moderate. It's not hard to be forceful when you're in a fury and cutting someone else. It's very difficult if you're injuring yourself. I explained all this. These certainly weren't defense injuries, I said. The two barristers looked at each other again, and then at the police officers. I noticed once more that, although the detectives had charged her with murder, it was clear they liked Teresa. One of them picked up the folder containing her pictures. Look at her face. Tony Pearson must have scratched her there, he said. I shook my head. No, these are fingernail injuries. I held a hand up to my own face and mimed scratching it in exactly the same way, in exactly the same place. If I remember rightly, the victim's fingernails were bitten down. They were far too short to make these scratches. I reached for the postmortem folder. The notes I had made at the postmortem were attached, and as I moved them, the air became lightly scented with that smell, its pungency like snapped elder branches of the mortuary. I flicked through the folder rapidly until I found a picture in which Anthony's fingers were clearly visible. Yes, he obviously bit his nails. They wouldn't have been sharp enough to inflict the scratches to her face. I handed it over. The detective studied it and passed it to senior counsel, who put on his glasses to peer closely before dropping it in front of junior counsel, who glanced at it with difficulty and then shut the book rapidly. I picked up the pictures of Teresa. On the other hand, I held one up in which her fingers were visible. Her nails are cut to a sensible length, but she could certainly scratch her own face with them. They passed it around, then there was a silence. And the bite mark on her arm? Demanded the first lawyer. She could reach her upper arm with her own mouth. I demonstrated, not very ably, by biting at my own arm. Then I opened the photograph folder again. And look carefully, the size of the bite marks indicate a small mouth, too small for a man. We can confirm that by measuring her mouth, of course, but we need to get a forensic odontologist to examine her. Bite marks are highly individual. There was another silence. I did notice in your statement, I said, turning to the inspector, that when Teresa appeared outside the police station, you initially called an ambulance, and then... When we examined the injuries, we cancelled it, he agreed. Because you didn't think they were too serious, I reminded him. Counsel asked, did you come here today expecting to tell us this? I hadn't seen the pictures, but I certainly intended to tell you that Teresa's version of events could not be true. I knew that when I read the transcript of her interview. The prosecution lawyers were looking excited, while the police officers were assuming the weary expression of those who suspect they have been duped. I was confident, at least partly because I had discussed this evidence with my colleagues back at Guy's, and we were all in agreement. I knew from the ligature marks that she could not have put the tie right around his neck, crossed it, and pulled it tight as she described. The tie did not go right around his neck. It did not cross. It went only across the front of his neck. I said, at first, I thought she must have strangled him from behind by pulling on both ends of the tie, but she's given this very accurate description of his face as he was being strangled. She did say she was at the front of him. That, at least, I believe. But if she did it in the way she describes, then a conscious adult male could have easily stopped her. They waited. A detective, his face puzzled, murmured, "So how?" Tony Pearson was very drunk, not far off 3 times the legal drink drive limit for alcohol. Also, he'd smoked cannabis, which would have magnified the effect of the alcohol. The most likely scenario is that he was lying on the bed, incapacitated. I think she must have simply held the tie across the front of his neck and pressed down. And he must have been too drunk to struggle. There's a good case for saying that he was face down, that she ran the tie under his neck and simply pulled back on the two ends. But then, she wouldn't have been able to describe his face so accurately as he died. The lawyer leaned forward. Are you telling us there was no fight in the flat? That she made it all up to justify the fact that she just... I think there was an argument in the flat. The neighbours heard something, after all. But it was on nothing like the scale she describes. There is no evidence that she was a victim of physical violence and that her action was self-defence. On the contrary, I believe that she must have strangled him when he was unconscious or barely conscious, then self-inflicted her injuries. Everyone looked at everyone else. No way do we take manslaughter for this one, said senior counsel. This is murder, and we're not going to let her get away with self-defence either. We shook hands and went in our different directions. The trial was scheduled for a few weeks' time, and we would next meet in court. In my earliest court appearances, I had been so nervous that I had only been able to stare back at whichever barrister was asking me questions. Or sometimes, if feeling bold, I'd looked at the judge. Ian West once came to watch me in the witness box. Afterwards, in the pub, he said, "So, who needs to believe you and understand your evidence?" In typical Ian fashion, he answered his own question before I could. Not counsel, that's for sure. Counsel knows what you're going to say, and he knows what he's going to try to make you say. As for the judge, you're not really in the business of convincing him either. The jury, Ian nodded his huge head. The jury, Dick, he rasped in his Scottish accent. The jury. Don't forget the jury. Of course, he was right. In court, Ian was in his element. 12 good citizens, and the public and press gallery too, was his idea of an audience, and he never failed to play to them. I am simply not an actor, and could not do courtroom drama any more than I could do emotional, loving husband. However, I did try to learn from Ian. I studied him in the Old Bailey, how he listened to counsel's question, thought for a moment, turned to face the jury, paused to take a deep breath and place his hands on the edge of the witness box, from which position they could make extravagant gestures, and then replied to the question as though the jury had asked it. His eyes ran constantly over their faces. He delivered his words with aplomb. For the jury, it must have been like having the entire Royal Shakespeare Company in their living room. There was no way I could emulate Ian's performance, but by the time the Lazenby case came up, I was turning to the jury as much as I could. Since I'm in court to offer scientific evidence and not to pass judgment, I tried then, and try now, not to look at the defendant. But in those early years, I sometimes failed to control my curiosity. I couldn't resist the urge to see the person accused of the heinous crime whose effects I had witnessed. I was often amazed at how nondescript most murderers seemed. So many looked like that mild-mannered individual you barely notice sitting next to you on the train until he obligingly picks up your ticket if you drop it. As I stepped up into the witness box in Regina versus Lazenby, I found myself sneaking a glance at the defendant. I saw a young woman who, as in the pictures taken immediately after the murder, was pretty, fresh-faced and alert. Her red hair hung in a neat and charming ponytail. When I gave evidence, her eyes glistened with tears. Her lawyer passed her a tissue. She dabbed at her cheeks and bowed her head. I saw members of the jury stare at her with compassion. How could this small, delicate woman be one of the UK's very few female stranglers? How could she have carried out this act in cold blood and then had the presence of mind to inflict false injuries all over her body before presenting herself tearfully at the police station? It seemed impossible. I almost doubted my own conclusions. Nevertheless, I held firm under cross-examination, and I learned later that the pathologist instructed by the defence to review my findings and opinions did not contest my report. He agreed that at least some, or even most, of Teresa's injuries were self-inflicted. The prosecution was insistent, based on my evidence, that Teresa had simply strangled her boyfriend when he was either unconscious or too incapacitated to struggle against her. All the indications were that Teresa had not needed to defend herself against the extremely drunk Anthony. But it was hard for anyone to believe a woman so sweet and remorseful could have done such a thing unless to save her own life. It was certainly hard for the jury to believe. They accepted her plea of self-defense and found her not guilty. Teresa's lawyers had successfully persuaded them that the prosecution had failed to prove their case beyond reasonable doubt. Beyond reasonable doubt is a high hurdle to jump, but the one that I would want applied if ever I found myself on the wrong side of the dock. Despite this, I was surprised when Teresa walked free from court. I knew that, through me, Anthony Pearson had spoken, but it was also patently clear that the jury had not listened. I felt they had ignored the evidence, and their verdict was simply a vote of sympathy for an allegedly abused woman. Jen raised her eyebrows that evening as I talked about the case extensively and from the heart. I explained how a woman I believed to be a murderer had just walked free. I suspected her youth and beauty were factors in her acquittal, and that seemed unfair. Well, it makes a change from a pretty young woman being the victim, Jen pointed out. She was baffled by her unemotional husband's rather emotional response to this court case. Even I was starting to feel uncomfortable at trespassing into an anger zone I usually avoided. I better pull myself together, I said. I can't get upset like this about every court case that goes the wrong way. And of course, I did pull myself together. The Lazenby case was probably the last time I allowed myself any emotional involvement in the outcome of a trial. It's my job to ascertain the scientific truth. I tell the jury that truth. They have the right to do with it what they will. After all, they hear all the statements and details of a case, which I seldom do. I now desire no further involvement once I have offered the facts. So, no more emotional payloads for me. No more sneaking a look at the defendant or grilling police officers on the outcome of a trial. Very often, I'm not informed of the verdict when I've given evidence in a case. If I don't spot reports in the newspaper, then I have to ask police officers or other colleagues who might have been involved. After the Lazenby trial, I decided never again to ask. I would be indifferent to the verdict and restrict my interest to my own evidence. I must feel no crusading zeal to see perpetrators behind bars, and no emotional need for the jury to vindicate my findings. Let Ian West put his heart and soul into his court performances and then suffer personal devastation if the jury found against his evidence. From now on in the witness box, I would perfect the art of emotional detachment I had learned in the mortuary. I told Jen this and she looked sad. More detachment, she said. It's your answer to everything. I shouldn't let myself care about verdicts. I'm sure that's right, I said. Jen shrugged. It was interesting watching you talk about that case with so much passion. Maybe you should do it more often. I shuddered. Passion. I certainly didn't want to feel that at all, let alone more often. It was the sort of thing that could get you into a lot of trouble. Chapter 18. In the late 1980s, the UK saw a series of disasters which claimed many lives. Few, if any, of these disasters could exactly be called an accident. They almost all exposed major systems failures. Or maybe this was a period when post-war values of self-reliance were morphing into conflicting interests of self and state. Certainly, attitudes were changing as the population grew, and the systems we relied on had to increase in size and complexity. In March 1987, the car and passenger ferry Herald of Free Enterprise capsized outside the Belgian port of Zeebrugge because the bow door had been left open. 193 passengers and crew died. In 1987, Michael Ryan went on a killing spree and shot 31 people in Hungerford before killing himself. In November 1987, a lighted match dropped down through an escalator on the Piccadilly line at King's Cross, causing a fire that claimed the lives of 31 people and injured 100 more. In July 1988, the Piper Alpha oil rig in the North Sea blew up, killing 167 men. On the 12th of December 1988, three trains collided due to signal failure just outside Clapham Junction. 35 passengers died and more than 400 were injured, 69 of them very severely. Later that month, a bomb planted on a Pan Am jumbo jet exploded over the Scottish town of Lockerbie, killing all 259 people on board and 11 on the ground. Less than 3 weeks later, on the 8th of January 1989, an engine fault developed in a British Midland Boeing 737, which, compounded with pilot error, brought down the plane on the embankment of the M1, just short of the runway at East Midlands Airport. Of 126 people on board, 47 died and 74 suffered serious injury. In April 1989, 96 Liverpool football fans were crushed to death and more than 700 were injured at Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield. It was only in 2016 that a second inquest ruled the victims were unlawfully killed due to gross negligence. The police, ambulance services and safety standards at the stadium were all criticised. In August 1989, a collision between a pleasure boat and a dredger in the Thames claimed the lives of 51 people, most of them under the age of 30. Each event shocked the nation. Each resulted eventually in significant improvements when emotions were calmer and the often multiple interconnected causes had been unravelled and analysed. Ancient systems were overhauled. The health and safety culture blossomed, some might say exploded. Employers began to recognise the importance of training, of corporate and state attitudes to risk and responsibility. These areas had suddenly become more serious, and security was no longer just a managerial afterthought, but a necessity. I was involved at emergency or inquiry stage with many of these events. Pathology learned a lot from them about how to deal with mass disasters, and so did I. It was the lessons of this watershed era that enabled us to cope efficiently with the terrorist horrors of the 2000s. For me, the first such case was Hungerford, but this was largely an era of transport disasters, and the first of these I worked on was the Clapham rail crash. A fast passenger train from the south coast, full of commuters, drove through a green light near Clapham Junction and rounded a bend on a Monday morning at 8:10 a.m., only to find that the slow service from Basingstoke had halted on the same tracks. An inevitable collision ensued, because the green signal should have been red, but wasn't. Because a wire was loose. Because the electrician had left it that way. Because he had taken only one day off in the preceding 13 weeks. And, although his managers thought his work was satisfactory, later investigations showed that it had, in fact, been poor, very poor, or simply unsafe for 16 years. It transpired that no one had supervised or inspected anything he did because he was trusted and because there was no culture of inspection. The fundamental trigger, however, was this. Everyone had been rushing to replace the signalling wiring. And why replace the wiring? Because it dated from 1936, and there was a need to ensure greater rail safety. We are now inside a law of nature that sometimes seems to account for the bulk of my work, the law of unforeseen consequences. At the collision, the fast train buckled to the right and hit a third train on the adjacent rails going the other way. Fortunately, this train was empty, heading back to Haslemere. The driver saw what was happening ahead of him, but had no time to stop. A fourth train, coming up behind the fast train, was travelling at speed, but because the electrical current had automatically shut off after the earlier crashes, it was slowing down and coasting around the bend. The driver managed to apply emergency brakes in time to narrowly avoid a further collision. The 35 people who died were all in the front two coaches of the fast train. These coaches were ripped open on one side. Closest to the point of impact, they completely disintegrated. The first senior fire officer on the scene, and the collision had inconveniently occurred in a deep and wooded cutting, looked down and immediately ordered 8 more fire engines, 8 ambulances and a surgical unit, as well as cutting and lifting equipment to extract trapped passengers. A disaster plan is all about the victims, but at an initial glance, so much of it seems not to be relevant. Traffic and parking may appear to be minor issues, but if these are not immediately controlled, rescue vehicles cannot get to or away from the site quickly. The site must be made accessible. In this case, trees and railings were removed. Hospitals must be put on alert, and the removal of the severely injured coordinated. Medical teams must arrive. Casualty centres for the walking wounded must be set up and managed. A casualty collection point must be provided, as well as a temporary mortuary. Every passenger must be accounted for, and this information must somehow be made available to anxious relatives. There were no mobile phones in 1988. There must be stretcher bearers and people delivering medical supplies to doctors, and the entire operation must be coordinated by a forward controller who has established radio links so that rescue workers can communicate. This is a huge task, and it must be carried out at speed. Speed is only possible after planning and practice. As it happened, the 12th of December 1988 was the first day the new A&E department at the nearest hospital, St George's in Tooting, was open. The staff who took the initial red alert disaster call had to be persuaded that the rail disaster was real and not a hoax from colleagues at another hospital. The total numbers involved in the Clapham rescue were vast. They came from all over London for the London Fire Brigade, the London Ambulance Service, the Metropolitan Police, the British Transport Police, the British Association for Immediate Care, specially trained doctors, mostly GPs, who are on call to leave their day jobs and rush to disasters, British Rail, the London Borough of Wandsworth, fortunately one of the very few local authorities in the country at that time to have its own emergency plan, which was put into immediate action, providing 134 invaluable staff. And of course, the Salvation Army, who arrived with a mobile canteen to offer physical relief in the form of drinks and food, but also psychological relief to rescuers, staff and relatives. The first role of the emergency services is certainly to take care of the living, to extract the trapped and to get casualties to safety as quickly as possible. Only after that come the dead. The London Fire Brigade, as first on the scene, having been assured the rail power was off, allowed the traumatised walking wounded to leave the train. They were escorted to casualty centres in the adjacent Emmanuel School and the Roundhouse Pub, and there was a collection point for them in Spencer Park. 67 ambulances were used to ferry the wounded to hospital. The 33 who died at the scene were removed along with any body parts. Initially, they were put in a temporary mortuary, but their stay was brief, as it should be. The coroner organised a fleet of undertakers to pick up the bodies and body parts from here. They were to be taken to the mortuary for full identification and autopsy. In any mass disaster, one of the key questions, as well as dealing with the wounded, is where do we put the dead? By 1:04 p.m, the last live casualty had been stretchered away from the train. By 3:40, the last body was removed from the wreckage. Unfortunately, no pathologist was sent to the scene, so there were no detailed pictures taken of the bodies in situ, which might have helped with identification, and it would certainly have assisted greatly in our analysis of the injuries. The mortuary chosen to receive the dead was that recently rebuilt and state-of-the-art facility, Westminster. 4 of us from Guy's went, including Ian, who was of course in charge, as well as Pam to keep us and the Metropolitan Police in order. Initially, we had no idea how many dead to expect, so we created a flow diagram showing how the bodies would progress through the mortuary. This started with the numbering, labelling and photographing of each body or body part on arrival. Each then went straight into a specific fridge labelled with that unique number. The four of us, helped by mortuary staff, were working simultaneously, and as soon as one of us was free, the next body, escorted by a police officer, was taken from its fridge and again photographed. This is a crucial part of the chain of evidence. We had to be able to prove that the body that came into the mortuary as body 23 was the body we examined as 23, and the body 23 was, eventually, when positively identified to the satisfaction of the coroner, the one released to the undertakers for burial. Initially, we did not carry out full postmortems, but focused on information that might identify the bodies. We described general appearance, any jewellery, clothing or tattoos, plus major obvious injuries like missing limbs. The police filled in ID forms. The bodies were fingerprinted and cleaned. They would be removed from their fridges a second time for full postmortem and for the retention of blood samples. Identification was, and is, the first priority for the pathologists in any mass disaster. There were many worried relatives, desperate for reliable information. The number of a call centre had been given out through the media for friends and relatives to phone, but it had no queuing system, so callers found it to be constantly engaged. One can only wonder at the anger and frustration that caused. But the lesson was learned, and call centres were organised and designed differently after that. There were 35 deaths, but over the ensuing day the call centre took 8,000 calls, and there were many more to hospitals and even mortuaries. If injuries were slight, the police gave information over the phone. Bad news was delivered personally by officers. It would have been all too easy, without proper care, to tell a woman her husband was dead when he wasn't, or vice versa. For instance, there were four people on the train with exactly the same name. Incredibly, two of them were in one carriage, but only one of them was dead. Fingerprints and dental records were at that time the only really dependable means of identification. It was no good relying on the loose personal effects like handbags or wallets that arrived with the bodies, as these almost invariably turned out to belong to someone other than the individual in that body bag. In addition, the police and fire service were so keen to remove all human tissue that a body bag containing three body parts very often contained the body parts of three different people and not one, as the rescuers must have assumed. There are about 60 separate body parts, heads, legs, jaws, internal organs, and they all had to be matched up. The coroner's staff and the police entered the details onto a database, and from this, gradually, complete human beings began to emerge in cyberspace. The male, aged about 44, 6 feet tall, slightly overweight, balding, birthmark on right shoulder, travelling in the train's front carriage, eventually turned into a person with a name. We were pleased to reach the point of positive identification, but of course at that same point, hope ended for friends and family. We continued working until the small hours of the next morning to get the first view finished. Then we went home to rest, in order to avoid fatigue errors, before returning early to begin the postmortems. The bodies of a few people who had died in hospital after the crash were now arriving. These added to our workload, but since these individuals had all been identified by relatives while in hospital, the process was much easier. Most of the dead at the very front of the train had been killed by severe injuries, not just from the initial impact, but by forcible ejection from their seats and hard contact with the unforgiving inside of the carriages. Some died of traumatic asphyxia because the tables they were sitting at were forced back into their abdomens, or because other objects fell onto them. There were many lessons learned from Ian West's overall report of our findings, including the need to anchor seats to the floor and to redesign hard surfaces to lessen their resilience in a collision. There were some calls for seat belts, but this was impractical and has never been implemented on trains. Overall, British Rail, which then controlled the signalling equipment, learned that there were many improvements to be made both to routine safety systems and to crisis systems. If any phoenix arose from the Clapham ashes, it was these improvements. And for me, there was a personal phoenix too. The mortuary after the disaster was a busy, focused place, and I got on with my job. As I looked at each victim, I remembered that they'd set off for work one morning and never arrived. Instead, they'd been crushed and severed, their families bereaved. The ramifications of that would continue for years, if not generations. I thought all this, but I could not allow myself to feel it, to feel anything. I knew that the intensity of my emotions was so strong that I could not have worked, and so the door on them had to be kept slammed tightly shut. At one point, I looked up to notice how very white the face was of the police officer who'd been at my side for some hours. I said, "Do you need a break? You don't look very well." He said, "Doc, I think I'm going to be all right, because there's one thing keeping me going." I waited for him to tell me that a pint at the pub or the embrace of his girlfriend would be his reward. He said, "My flying lesson." I must have misheard. I thought he'd mentioned something about flying. "Yes, Doc, as soon as I finish my shift, I've got a flying lesson." I stared at him. "You fly a plane?" I asked, incredulous. "That's something I've always wanted to try." I did not add, "but have never been able to afford." Well, hasn't everyone wanted to fly? But the idea of finding the money, then fitting flying into my everyday life, slotted somewhere between home, giving lectures, departmental meetings, postmortems, and court appearances, well, it seemed barely worth considering. The officer said, "I'll tell you, the fresh air up there beats the smell of the mortuary any day." I looked around me at the collection of crushed limbs we were now investigating. Did I need anyone to tell me that the clouds are a better place to be? The policeman said, "The Met has a flying club, that's how I do it. If you're interested, I reckon you could join, seeing how closely you work with us." A few weeks later, I found myself at Biggin Hill, precisely at the threshold of runway 21. More precisely, inside a two-seater Cessna 152, beside a police officer who was also a qualified flying instructor. We'd sat with cups of coffee while he briefed me on this, my first lesson, and then, heart beating wildly, fingers shaking with excitement, a buzz in my stomach that felt like raw terror, I opened the throttle and runway 21 unspooled before me. "Pull back gently when we reach 50 knots," said my instructor. "Gently!" I did so, and the nose of the plane lifted. There was a heart-halting moment as the rumble of the wheels on the tarmac faded, then stopped. And suddenly all I could hear was the whoosh of the wind and the noise of the engine. Yes, we were airborne. We climbed. Up. Up. The deep blue horizon shifted further down. I looked at our speed. 75 knots. We passed a cloud. Just flew past it. The way the bus passed me in the mornings when I was about to miss it. I was flying through thin air, in a tiny metal box. And I wasn't falling down. I realized I'd been holding my breath. I exhaled. I inhaled. I dared to look below me. The houses of Greater London were behind us, and I could see all the way to the south coast, all the way to Brighton. My eyes rested on the sheer, stunning beauty of the countryside laid before me like a feast, like a woman in her finery, like a work of art, a picnic of clouds. I felt elated. I was really flying. I was leaving behind the sad and the drab, mortuaries full of the still bodies of humans devoid of human spirit, the small failures, the niggling worries, the disappointments, the silences at home, the recent spate of that annoying compromise, cause of death unascertained, the idiotic vanities and the frustrating rivalries, all the joyless trivia which can paint life grey had simply disappeared, to be replaced by this surge of wild happiness. I concentrated on the controls of a small plane suspended somewhere over Kent. I knew that if flying could make me feel this way, I must never give it up. Ever. Chapter 19. I gave up flying after 5 hours of lessons. The fire in our house created such an array of complications and pressures that wild surges of unbounded joy were driven right off the agenda. Spending my very limited spare time alone with an instructor in the air, when I should have been spending it with my family, began to look downright selfish. So it was back to PM40s by day and chores by night, cooking, writing up post-mortem reports, phoning builders, back down to earth. Not that life was boring. I loved the variety of my work. In 1 week I might have a suicide by shotgun, a carbon monoxide poisoning, a drowning, a knife murder, a drug overdose, a variety of sudden natural causes. Each had its own fascination, as long as one detached oneself from the emotional payload death carried for the living who surrounded it. Drug overdoses were still rare, particularly if the user had died with a needle in the arm. That was certainly something to show interested colleagues. Today, of course, these cases are simply routine. There was a strong possibility that the deceased, if an intravenous drug user, was HIV positive, and so drugs deaths triggered elaborate safety precautions. AIDS was still sufficiently new and unexplained to be terrifying, and in those days of ignorance about its transmission, fear stalked hospital corridors. Ian West had become the UK's, and perhaps the world's, foremost expert in death by bullet or bomb. His career had peaked alongside IRA activity, and his work regularly made headlines. I did appreciate the breadth of the cases I dealt with, but colleagues hinted that I, too, should find an area in which to develop special expertise. What, though? Drugs deaths were a growing trend, so was death by glue sniffing, but these generally demanded more of toxicologists than forensic pathologists. Babies? No thanks. I felt that few pathologists could enjoy working on such morally complex and emotionally draining cases, although in fact this specialisation was to explode in significance and complexity over the coming years. My intellectual curiosity drew me towards knives, a method of homicide as old as mankind and one I predicted would last on this planet as long as man does, or woman. One of the interesting aspects of homicide by knife is that it is very often a woman's weapon of choice. The knife in every kitchen drawer in the land is a murder waiting to happen, and it is easy to use. No training or specialist knowledge is required, not even much force, really. All that is needed is the ability to get close to the victim. But it was not the domestic or street nature of knife murders that interested me so much as the fact that, increasingly, from the incisions themselves, I often felt I could attempt to reconstruct the events surrounding the homicide. And although I was coming to terms with the fact that, post-Simpson, the police didn't seem to regard reconstructions as proper evidence, and lawyers less and less often had the time or inclination to hear them, I could not entirely abandon the reason I had become a forensic pathologist, to help solve death's puzzle. I don't think I actively made a decision to be a knife specialist. It just seemed to find me. And my interest was sealed after a call out on a sunny Sunday autumn morning when I'd woken early to see the clear sky and wish, sadly, I could fly a little aeroplane through it. A burned house was healed and sold. We had passed through the chaos of moving. The new house was in something like order, but I knew that taking time out from work and family to continue my flying lessons was still simply out of the question. The leaves were turning colour as I headed off through the crisp, cold morning towards a village where an elderly man had been found in his kitchen with his throat slashed. As I neared the address, I met a line of police cars parked at the roadside. A harassed young constable was trying to persuade a knot of gossiping neighbours to move back. The old man had lived in one of those big, early council houses, detached and built to last from solid black and red brick. The neighbours fell silent as I approached. They listened as I identified myself to the constable. Then, as he lifted the crime scene tape and I walked through, they all started to talk at once. In the corner of my eye, I glimpsed someone in a police car, a woman, head in hands. "I'm the coroner's officer. Thanks for coming so quickly," said a big, red-faced man at the door, who I guessed at once was, like many coroner's officers at that time, a former policeman. Soccos were busy with their evidence bags, and there were a couple of senior detectives. A police photographer arrived. "That's the daughter," muttered the coroner's officer, gesturing to the police car in which the woman sat. Phoned and couldn't get a reply. Rushed straight over. In the kitchen, near the back door, feet stretching to the entrance of the living room, lay the body of an elderly man. "Mr. Joseph Garland, 82 years old," the coroner's officer murmured in my ear. Mr. Garland lay on his right side. His clothes were bloodstained. Beneath him, the kitchen floor was bloodstained. The mat was bloodstained. The cupboards and walls were bloodstained. He wore pyjamas with a tweed jacket thrown over the top. His hands were bloody. His feet were bare. By the open back door stood a pair of bloody Wellington boots. I could hear the two detectives talking behind me. So they bang on the door, or maybe he just sees them outside in his garden. He throws on the jacket, gets into his boots, goes out there, and they knife him, but he manages to get back into the house, probably reaching for the phone. I looked back at Mr. Garland. The bloodstaining was unusually distributed. His jacket and pajamas were heavily stained on the front. Confusingly, the blood extended down to the upper calf. There was no blood below this except on the soles of his feet. The Wellington boots, however, were bloodstained on the outside and in a narrow rim on the inside at the top. It was obvious that he'd been wearing the wellies at or after the time he received the injuries. Then he'd taken them off when he came into the house. They stood neatly in what was almost certainly their accustomed place by the door. The owner probably had a long-practiced, ingrained habit of stepping out of them as he entered. I bet he once had a wife who nagged him about bringing mud onto the kitchen floor, I said to no one in particular. I stared out into the back garden, which was being combed now by a number of police officers. I saw a trail of blood leading to the greenhouse. Outside it, Mr. Garland's pots were stacked. Inside, through dirty windows, the summer's tomato plants were visible. They were brown, dying off as autumn closed in. Beyond the greenhouse was a garage and parking area. A deep pool of blood was visible in the parking area. Clearly the wound had been inflicted here. A red car stood nearby at an odd angle, the driver's door not properly shut as if someone had leapt out in a hurry. "It's the daughter's," explained the coroner's officer. The photographer had finished his initial work now, and I went back to the body. I rolled Mr. Garland over, and a huge, incised wound on the side of his neck, just above the jacket, gaped at me. A knife had cut through the muscles and the right jugular vein and partially severed the carotid artery. There were a number of other horizontal wounds across the throat, but none so deep as the wound that had most certainly killed him. I felt his arms and legs. Rigor mortis had set in, but was not fully established in the legs. I took his temperature. Another policeman was listening intently to his radio. Suspicious van. Two men, early 20s, approached a pensioner this morning. Asked if he had any gardening work. The van was a white Ford. Registration probably included letters T and K. "Get someone out there looking for it," said a senior voice, who then introduced himself to me as a detective superintendent. I'd been crouching by the body and stood up now. "Could you ask his daughter if he was left-handed?" The super looked at me for a moment and then disappeared to the police car. Through the open door, I heard Mr. Garland's tearful daughter confirm that he was indeed left-handed. She knew what this question meant, even perhaps before the detective, because she began to wail. "I don't think this is a murder investigation," I said when the detective came back. The officers, busy around the scene, inside and out, all seemed to freeze. "This wound is self-inflicted. I'm afraid Mr. Garland killed himself." The super shook his head. "That was our first thought. But we've searched high and low for a knife and there just isn't one." "There must be." The detective began to look annoyed. "You can't kill yourself and then dispose of the weapon. There's no weapon here. This is a homicide." "Maybe he dropped the knife into the bushes." The super gestured to his team of officers, even now busy in the flower beds. "This is their second sweep of the garden. It's not that big and there's no knife." I was sure the knife was there. I was sure the old man had killed himself. I paused and considered. How sure was I? The detective was glaring at me. "You don't know anything until you do the post-mortem, Doc. People always think that by opening the bodies of the dead, I will find their secrets locked inside, like someone who cracks safes. But in this case, I already knew a great deal from careful study of the body's external appearance. There was no point in arguing, as I would have to do a post-mortem anyway. I turned back to the coroner's officer. "Can you arrange to take him to a mortuary now?" He nodded and called over two uniformed police officers. "Right, let's get him bagged up and over to the Royal Surrey." I turned back to the super. I was confident. "Of course I'll do the post-mortem, but I'm sure this is a suicide." "What makes you so sure?" he asked me, and not pleasantly. It was a tone I knew already, but I'd rarely encountered it at the scene of a crime, where there is generally quiet, good-natured teamwork. No, that sneer belonged in court, employed by a senior defence barrister setting out to humiliate a pathologist whose evidence inconveniences his client. I responded in my most clinical voice. "First, a sight of the injury. Mr. Garland has cut himself several times, and the site he's chosen is absolutely typical of self-inflicted incisions. They're nearly always on the neck or the wrists. He cut the right side of the neck, which would be most unlikely if he was right-handed. But you've just confirmed that he was left-handed. And look at all those smaller injuries. They're parallel. The detective glanced reluctantly at the old man's neck. I pointed to the thin, superficial lines of blood on either side of the large slash wound and explained hesitation injuries to him. We don't know exactly why people do this. Perhaps they're just building up their courage, preparing for the pain, or trying to find the right place. But hesitation injuries are strong indicators of suicide. The detective still looked skeptical. Those lines always mean it's suicide? In my experience, that is usually the case. My experience at the time was not so very extensive, but I didn't plan to tell the officer that. If he cut himself out there, the detective indicated the pool of thick blood in the parking area, and died just here, how much time would he have had to dispose of the knife? I thought. Up to a minute. Not that he would have been able to hide the knife after losing all that blood. He might have been able to throw it, but he had almost certainly just dropped it. The detective, who really seemed to want a homicide to brighten up his Sunday, said, "Someone could have knifed him and run off with the weapon." Well, it's possible. You admit the possibility that his wound was inflicted by someone else. I hesitated. Of course it was possible. Anything was possible. But it was my job to collect and present evidence, not to speculate on every wild theory. I said, "It's unlikely, but it's possible." The detective looked triumphant. "However, I believe that the knife must be here," I said, "and in a fairly obvious place." The team looking for the knife heard this. They paused. Some put their hands on their hips. Others stood straight, staring at me. They had been searching for a while now, and didn't want to hear they had missed something obvious. I went out through the little back door, past the bloody Wellington boots, past the greenhouse and the old clay flower pots, past an ancient tin bath that lay on its side, following the blood trail to its source. He lost a lot of blood, and he was losing more fast as he moved back towards the house. I really think he would have just dropped the knife somewhere near this spot, rather than throwing it, I said. Perhaps the daughter? Says she hasn't touched a thing. When there is a suicide, often a relative or friend suspects it has taken place. Perhaps Mr. Garland had threatened suicide, or maybe he had just seemed very depressed. I tried to imagine the middle-aged daughter arriving at speed in her red car, heart beating, scared of what she might find. The first thing she would have seen was the pool of blood. Her car had screeched to a halt just short of it, and, leaving the vehicle askew across the parking area, barely even shutting the door, she would have jumped out and run into the house to find her father. "No knife, no suicide," stated the detective firmly. "Could you reverse her car, please?" Everyone looked at everyone else, and the detective went to ask the daughter for the keys, then came out and slowly backed the car away from the parking area. Beneath the wheel's original position lay a bloody, bone-handled bread knife. The detective can have had no idea of the relief I felt at having my theory confirmed. I had probably sounded very sure of myself. And I was very sure. But deep down I have, since childhood, recognized that life is a series of unexpected twists and turns. This knowledge enslaves me. Although it is my job to be certain, I was unable that day, and am still unable, to escape a greater certainty that there are always other possibilities. Chapter 20. By now, I was beginning to suspect that my attempts to reconstruct homicides from the track of stab wounds might just be eclipsed by a technique which had recently appeared on the distant periphery of forensic work. People had started to talk about DNA testing. DNA, they said, would be a better means of identification than fingerprinting or any of our other current methods. We discussed it in the pub during one of our raucous office Friday lunchtimes, our debate leaking into the afternoon, the secretaries and technicians all joining in. Was DNA the future? Or one of those technological advances which would have no workable application for years and years? The new developments did make me wonder if my special interest in the track of stab wounds would soon be so old-fashioned it would help no one. My fascination with the idea did not abate. but it happened that at around that time another specialization seemed to find me. At first I tried to ignore it, but somehow it managed to kick me hard in a vulnerable place I scarcely knew I had, my social conscience. I did think I already worked for society. Forensic pathologists help families and state to understand the dead and so find justice, didn't they? I was rather slow to take on board the idea that I personally might have a more direct role to play in bringing about social change. Working closely with the police at the scene of a crime was a part of my job. Their professionalism and camaraderie made the chaos, blood, filth and human tragedy of the average homicide a lot easier to deal with. When I had a good relationship with the officers involved, they sometimes kept me informed as their investigations progressed, and I valued that. How hard it was, then, to bear witness to another sort of policing, one that had little in common with the dignified, serious men and women I encountered. On arriving at a hospital mortuary for post-mortem one night, the information I was given at the briefing was a bit sketchy. I soon gathered why. The patient had died while in the care of the prison system. I noticed that there was no banter or small talk as we changed and walked into the post-mortem room to examine the body. The deceased was a 28-year-old Nigerian. An external examination revealed abrasions on the front of his nose and around the lips. I saw he had recent bruising to his arms and particularly around his wrists, as well as on his abdomen. I said, "So was he wearing a body belt when he died?" They nodded glumly. A body belt is an unattractive contraption consisting of a thick, heavy leather belt with handcuffs passing through a ring on each side. The belt, of course, goes around the abdomen and the wrists are attached to it by the handcuffs. When I examined the deceased internally, I found that he had severe atheroma, furring up of the arteries, but only in one place. Inside a carotid artery, the main artery in the neck that takes blood to the brain. Very unusual in a 28-year-old. In a few years' time, that might well have become life-threatening, but it certainly did not cause his death. Further tests showed that he also had sickle cell trait. Sickle cell disease is the UK's fastest-growing genetic disorder. It is carried by millions of people worldwide, mostly of African or Caribbean origin. Those who suffer from it are more likely to survive malaria, not very useful in metropolitan London. But that's the end of the good news. It is caused by a mutation in the hemoglobin gene, and hemoglobin's vital function is to transport oxygen around the body. In healthy individuals with normal hemoglobin, these red blood cells are fat and round with a dimple in the middle, not unlike a ring donut. And most importantly, they are bendy. The sickle cell genetic mutation swaps one amino acid, and this means that the hemoglobin folds differently. For most of the time, that's not a problem. But when the hemoglobin molecule is not holding onto an oxygen molecule, it can become stiff and fixed in an unusual shape. In this case, red blood cells can look like odd bananas or sickles, hence the name of the disease. The result of the stiffness and strange shape is that instead of flowing smoothly through the blood vessels, the blood cells tend to pile up, interlock, and block the vessels, starving vital organs of oxygen. Pains in the joints and abdomen, and often anemia, are just the start of the problems these blockages can cause. Sufferers were once virtually guaranteed a short life, but increasing knowledge of the disease and new drug treatments are changing all that, and maybe gene therapy will soon be available to help further. The full, severe disease means that the individual has inherited the same faulty gene from both parents. This is called homozygous, and as a result, sufferers can only make the faulty hemoglobin. However, inherit one faulty gene from one parent and one normal gene from the other, and sufferers are called heterozygous. They can make some normal hemoglobin as well as some faulty hemoglobin. These individuals will have the lesser form of the disease, which, not surprisingly in a genetic disorder of this sort, is even more widespread than full sickle cell disease. This is called sickle cell trait. Sickle cell trait was for a long time thought to have no significant impact on those who had it, unless they caught malaria. Only in recent decades has it been recognized as a major risk factor in certain circumstances. And those are circumstances that in any way significantly deprive sufferers of oxygen. So, no climbing Everest for those with sickle cell trait. In fact, sickle cell trait sufferers should avoid all situations where there may be any threat of oxygen deprivation at all. So as well as climbing high mountains, that includes